Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to introduce our next guest, Carlos Saloom. He is the founder of Saloom International Resources and author of the book, The Glass is Full and a Half. He is a leadership performance strategist and a mental toughness coach whose journey started growing up under the military dictatorship in Argentina and led him to coaching world champion tennis players, professional race car drivers, and executives who lead organizations all around the globe. He is an amazing individual with a tremendous perspective, a wonderful outlook, and his ability to connect with people and help them get the most out of themselves in pressure-packed situations is outstanding. And I'm really excited that he took the opportunity to share his time, his insights, and his expertise with us today. He's really going to talk to us about how we can perform our best under pressure, how we can design our breakthrough moments, how we can shift our thinking and our emotions at any point in time. And one that really grabbed me was how we can improve by managing our energy instead of our time. He has so much value to share, and I'm really excited for everybody to hear it today. Of course, thank you all for taking the time to listen to another conversation. I really appreciate you being here, and I hope you get as much of this from this conversation as I did. I certainly want to thank our sponsors as well. We have HumanTel. Head over to humantel.com and check out all of their blogs, articles, research, and resources as you consider whether or not their training is right for you. If you do decide to take their training, please enter the code INCUASIVE25 for 25% off what I truly believe to be the best in-class online self-paced training for learning how to identify what somebody's thinking or feeling by recognizing how their emotions are changing in real time through their facial expressions and body language, and then unlocking the intelligence that that provides us in any conversation. I've taken the training myself. I highly vouch for it. Head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCUASIVE25 for 25% off. We also have the International Association of Interviewers. Please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com to check out all of the resources they have available, from in-person and online educational events to their online resources for interviewers to the networking opportunities. And of course, you have the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation while you're there. Check that out and see if that level of expertise or that designation is best for you at this point in your career. And Inquasive. Please head over to Inquasive.com to check out the courses that we are asked to facilitate for organizations all around the world who ask us to come in and work with their leadership teams, their sales teams, and their HR teams to teach them the skills, perspectives, and techniques necessary to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. You can see so much more about what we do and how we do it over at Inquasive.com. Once again, thank you all very much for taking the time to be here. I truly appreciate it. And without further ado, I introduce to you Carlos Saloom. Good morning, Carlos. It is so great to see you. Thank you very much for sharing your time with me.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure. And I love the topic, disciplined thinking, listening. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And I love your topic as well. I know it goes well beyond, but for right now, mental toughness and working with professional athletes and elite business people and beyond, and I'm sure we'll get into many examples. Your background is amazing. The work that you do is amazing. I'm super excited to be able to share it with our audience. I'm going to be honest, I'm also super excited to try to learn a little bit myself as well from our conversation, because as my wife reminds me, my internal monologue or dialogue could certainly use a little bit of recalibration from time to time. So if you don't mind, I'd really like to open up and ask you there. You are an elite peak performance strategist advisor to leaders and professional athletes around the world. So from your perspective, what is perhaps the most important adjustment we can all make with how we talk to ourselves?
Well, we have figured out in sports performance that the path to peak performance starts with the sequence of how I think, how I feel, and how I act. But I can also act and feel certain things, especially in a positive way, that shift my thinking. So that dynamic is very important because under pressure, when the clock is ticking, when there is a lot of money or prestige or a title on the line, esports becomes really the lab, the demonstration of, as a skill, how we can shift. So this thinking, feeling, acting sequence is sustained by the internal monologue. Now, for example, in my sport in tennis, the magic of mental toughness happens in between points, not while we're playing the point. Because in between points, there are four stages that are very distinct. And it's getting away from the fight when the point is over. Then we need to control physiology. So you're going to see the players looking at the strings and walking back to the baseline. At that moment, they better have positive self-talk, because otherwise they are wasting time. The phrase, we cannot waste time on a negative thought, So why become the enemy of myself when I need the recovery? That might be 6 to 15 seconds, because only then I can think clearly about what I'm going to do in the next point and do my rituals to get an automatic feeling that I'm ready. And then we play reacting to patterns. So if we're in a meeting and we feel negativity creeping in, I have to have a similar approach in which I just stop, because I have either a mantra or a gesture or a certain word that might put me back on the positive aspect. One simple basis is there an alternative? I heard something I don't like, or I see something I don't like, and instead of allowing the negativity boil up, which is normal, no? I can feel the feeling, but I can also say, what's the alternative? Is there another way? What are they actually saying? That's where the discipline listening comes in as well. I can pull all these skills in a few seconds to shift and ask a question or propose something or say, picture this, as the alternative. And then I just basically regain my path, An important skill that helped me personally and that I introduce in my work with clients is the ability to shift thinking, because it can shift emotions, and also doing certain things that can shift both, the feeling, the thinking, such as a certain gesture that encapsulates that shift. But the shift in thinking is also part of creative thinking skills, in which I intentionally look at something and try to find alternative, even in a playful way. Humor is a very important tool to do it almost automatically, If something in a conversation, let's say in product development, might be blocked, we run out of ideas, we don't see where the creativity could be, we don't see the value very clearly, we can crack a joke, we can ridicule something about the object, the product, the service, and that is giving ourselves permission to play, to look at the issue in a different way. So to summarize, with listening, there is an intuitive way, some people can do that, but it's better to have a disciplined approach in which you know that there are certain tools that you can do with thinking, or you can do with feeling, because you basically shift the emotion, or you can change your posture or do something differently and come back and have a different perception.
Certainly. Already, you've touched on so many things I want to get back and dive into, from redefining problems and how we can approach different situations. But you mentioned something a few times as we begin to change how we're speaking to ourselves. And that can be using a gesture or using even a specific word. You mentioned changing posture as well. Are there specific, I should start by saying some of this is going to be unique to everybody. Yeah. If yes. I'm trapped in the cockpit of a Formula One race car, there's only so many postures or gestures I can use to try to reframe. If I have the freedom of being standing on a tennis court, obviously that I'm a little bit more room to move. If I'm in a boardroom, that might be kind of in the middle. I'm still a little bit restricted, but not quite as much. Have you seen common gestures or postures or word choices that your clients can repeatedly rely on in order to try to ignite that shift?
Yes. Now, it's a great question because you can come from a macro aspect, from activities and situations that are commonplace and anybody can use, to the very specific, like you said, tennis court, cockpit, or on stage, no? So the one that is very useful for all of us is posture. The awareness of how am I standing, you know, eyes up, head up, shoulders back. How are my feet? How are they pointing? You know, the width of the legs relative to the shoulders. So I teach these very young athletes early on, and then others who might not be very expressive or not connect very well with their projection of their energy, because posture allows us to then analyze how we walk, how you enter a room, how you exit a room, how you move around the room. In sports, prowling like a tiger on your territory, if it's defined like a court or a field, you're going to see it at some point, you know, that body language. But it's also intentional in leaders, no? And it's taught in very specific ways. Mm-hmm. There are very good TED Talks about this aspect of how do I project my energy by shifting how I stand, how I walk, no? And they all lead to a bit of expansion, no? I want to show confidence because I'm showing confidence first to myself. And as I feel that this acting lesson to myself is working, I feel the feelings I need to feel, I can then breathe differently and project as I am delivering, no? And then I can read the people's expressions because I see that I'm engaging, no? This is working. So that is very good feedback for me, no? It reinforces that this is a habit that I want to keep. You know, it's suddenly I have a reward for this, no? So that is really very useful. Zero cost, not much risk, you know? And then it becomes very specific because as I was talking about these four stages in between points in tennis, or how I analyze what my Formula One, Formula Two drivers, the young car drivers behave under pressure, is that pressure determines those responses. Even if no one had analyzed, like we did with Dr. Jim Lehrer, sports psychologist, in the 90s with slow motion video, these issues, pressure will force us to make certain things, you know, to behave in certain ways so we can sustain it and go through, you know? So it's very interesting that the patterns are there because that's how we respond to pressure, you know? But if we know how to analyze them and how they can be unpacked and categorized and how many seconds does it last, when do you need to do it, it's so much more useful, no? So yes, in a cockpit, in a Formula One car, it comes down to how I talking to myself, the pressure that I might apply to the tools, no? So I can flow, not too much, not too little. how I recover from mistakes or things that others are doing, no? In milliseconds, no? And I regain this flow. I regain my connection to what is called the ideal performance state. So all these tools allow me to define that there is an ideal performance state in which I feel in the present, I'm breathing normally, is joyful. That's the most important thing. That's a thermometer. Huh? I'm not thinking about the past. I'm very much centered on what I'm saying, doing, no? And basically, I know that I can replicate this, no? It's a space that I really want to inhabit and embody.
That point about being able to replicate it, I think, is likely especially important. And yeah. I am fascinated having the conversation around sports. It also applies to business as well, because people find themselves having to lead through similar meetings with similar groups or give similar presentations or solve similar problems and getting into that same flow, that same groove. Oh, now I can reflect on how I felt and performed in this conversation. I can replicate that in upcoming conversations as well. In that explanation, you mentioned recovering from mistakes. Mm-hmm. And in my own life, when I think about my personal life, my business life, and even athletic endeavors that I still participate in, not at the level of your clients, but at the athletic endeavors I still participate in, I find recovering from mistakes to be one of the most important, but also one of the most challenging things to do. So from your expertise, what are some approaches or techniques people can use to help recover from the inevitable mistakes that we're all going to make and start working their way back to that ideal performance state as quickly as possible?
Yes. Let's consider that we have time to recover. No? Let's say it's goals. There is more space in between actions. It's important to turn away from the mistake. So you just basically wipe out the mental screen. It's a switch. And then you can breathe, because breathing from three deep breaths onwards, it basically cools the brain, according to sports science. No? So then I can maybe walk it off. No? And I can laugh about it. I can, like you see gestures, you know, on TV that just take it easy. But then I can start being analytical. No, I need to know why it happened. Even if I crash the car, but in golf I also need to know. In tennis, you are gonna see the players rehearse the correction of the mistake in a few seconds. And then I can create some space, a few more circles that in some sports you can elongate, no? Because I need to have my heart rate at the level at which I can think logically. Now I can plan ahead. Okay, and the next one, I do this, so I get this result, or I open these options, no? Where even when you're in flow in a 200 mile an hour car at high speed, you are flowing from one understanding of this curve, and I'm anticipating the other two moves, you know, in milliseconds. I'm planning, you know.
Yes.
And then I just execute, no? And I execute because I feel the heart rate at the right level. I am visualizing what I thought logically, and I can use the long exhalation as insurance not to choke. No? That would be in sports, no? if we're in a meeting and I make a mistake, it could be humor, you know, because I diffuse, no? I can ask permission, no, to recap, and if I don't know something, I'll get back to you, I'll check, or let me analyze this for a second, no? I'll reconfirm. Maybe there was a mistake on the Excel chart. That's very common. So where the, and then I reconfigure because I really need to keep the flow of the mental movie of the person to whom I'm listening. So I'm thinking, for example, about sales, you know?
Yes.
I engage someone in a conversation in which what I'm describing hopefully creates a mental image that becomes a dynamic cinematic And the brain says, tell me more. I got it. Tell me more. No, that's something that I had to learn from playwriting.
Really?
But then it was validated in working with bankers and people who had to persuade with a very chain logic until there is a decision. I would be very interesting to see how you see this playing out, no, in discipline listening. So that's basically the approach, no? There is a sequence. There is a sequence. I need to control my physiology, and there is a way. And it's I can master it, in which, let's say, we went through golf, having more time as an example, but I can do it very quickly. No? And humor always is a great tool, no, as well. With people at ease, and I'm human. we're co-creating this in a way, you know. It's there is this famous portion of Joseph Campbell's presentations in which he's listening to a Japanese expert, and he has a pile of paper in his hands, and suddenly, seemingly, you know, the papers fall on the floor, and it's a disaster. He will not be able to follow, you know, the train of thought, but it was a trick, actually, because everybody helps to get the papers, and then he puts the papers away. It doesn't matter. What was more important is to engage everybody inside. So even that's another example. I need the right physiology first, you know, to keep going.
From my limited perspective, I agree entirely. I was very fortunate to, one of the earlier interviews I had for the podcast, interview David Matsumoto, who is a behavioral scientist as well as an Olympic judo coach.
Right.
And when I was interviewing him, I asked him similar questions about how we can prepare and handle stress and things like that. And he said that he believes, and I agree, one of the most important things we can do is expand our capacity to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Which again works to our physiology, because if I'm rushed, if I'm panicked, if I'm fear stricken, all that blood and oxygen is going someplace other than where I need it. So Hearing that breathing cools the brain fascinates me, and hearing you say get our heart rate to a level where we can think logically or think clearly, that makes entire sense. So however we choose to do that, I find that to be extremely important as well. And I do love the humor idea, being self-deprecating, moving on. If it's a mistake for us, if we're making a presentation, own it, move on, get to the next point, get to the next step. The sport that I still participate, well, I coach my son's youth sports, so I guess that technically is participating in sports, but I still train and occasionally compete in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And one of the things that I try to think is, when I make a mistake, which I do all the time, is what is the first recovery step? So Do I just need to get my elbow someplace? Do I need to get my chin tucked in? Do I need to get on my right hip? Just try to focus on that one thing. And then once I've got that one thing, okay, what's the next thing? So I'm not trying to solve 1,000 problems at once. I'm just trying to solve one incremental problem at a time. Honestly, usually internal monologue, making fun of myself for making the mistake that got me to where I was to get out of there. So no, that tracks. That makes a lot of sense. You write a lot, and we're going to talk about your book, of course. It's called The Glasses Full and a Half, which I love the title of. And you talk about being an optimist and selling optimism, which I feel is fantastic. But you write in your book a lot about breakthrough.
Yeah,
and people, your systems for leading people to breakthroughs and how they can experience their own breakthroughs. So knowing that we all find ourselves in situations where we feel stuck, or we feel hopeless, or we feel lost, or, you know, possibly even comparing to some of the athletes that you work with, we feel disappointed that we've let ourselves down or somebody else down, or, you know, we've never quit in our whole life, but here we are maybe considering quitting at this moment in time. What are the processes that any of us normal people can use to work ourselves from those low points back to breakthrough moments?
Yes. This is a very existential question, because I always go back to that famous question from the Holocaust survivor who says, if everything is so bad, so horrible, why haven't you killed yourself yet? Yeah. So what is keeping you on, like, dinner tonight or being able to breathe tomorrow? I mean, the most basic things, no? And I think it's an important thing to answer, because, and I do this when I encounter teams, and this happened recently. This company is very successful today, but the team, when they do the lifeline exercise and they have the courage, you know, which I applaud, you know, we're meeting with them in all their lives. Every one of them has a degree of trauma that is off the charts compared to the regular population. So they have a resilience quotient that is enormous. And that is part of the success. And many times they haven't even considered, no? So I asked them, why didn't you quit, you know, when you could, when you were so low? And it's always finding that something can pull us forward. It's not duty, obligation, or just survival, which will be there, no? What am I going to do tonight, tomorrow? But we all find something that is greater than today, no? Which would justify doing the work. So today is better than tomorrow. That's the absolute basics of training and improvement, no? So that's why in the book and in my analysis of what are the most common words that can define this process is imagine, no? Then improve. Then inspire, because I inspire myself first when I see where I came from, even within a week, a month, you know, a year. And then when I'm inspiring others, I might be able to ignite the replication of what I'm doing. I'm going to be invited to do other things, you know, opportunities open up, no? And maybe I teach as well, no? So I think it goes back to the question of, is there an alternative, which is at the basis of creative thinking. I'm blocked. I don't know what to do. There is despair, no resources. Is there an alternative? No, because if I can do something incremental, and this goes back to Kaizen and 1% improvement, if I have a 1% difference today, just start. No, and in many cases, we have this coalescence of stories of comeback and breakthrough that go back to that moment, no? The inciting incident, the shift in thinking. Sometimes the opportunity comes from outside, no? It's great when you have the opportunity of having someone who says, I've been watching you and I think you need this, you know? But if I have to drive it, I'd rather say, okay, is there an alternative? And what is the immediate thing? Because I need to change my physiology somehow, no? Many times we have these pilgrimages, you know, people just walk. And walking pumps the blood, the brain shifts, I'm breathing differently, you know? And I can have a different perspective when I arrive to, let's say, a mile down the road, no? Yeah.
Yeah, on the walking piece, there's where my office is a downtown area with city blocks. So I will, if I find myself really stuck, I'll get out and go for a walk. And, you know, I probably won't walk a mile, to be honest, in the middle of the day, because I just don't want to take that much time. But I'll go walk about a 4-block loop and then yes. I'll come back. And so now I come back maybe 15, 20 minutes later, something like that. But I am in a different place. And it doesn't always lead to that immediate, well, now I can finish writing this article or now I can finish building this presentation. But it definitely helps put me in a better mindset after yes. getting up and moving instead of sitting here, which I'm also have been guilty of doing a million times, staring at my computer, trying to will it to finish what I'm trying to do, but can't get myself through the moment.
Yes. And also, I just basically define the individual route, but it's also asking for help. And so that's where the listening to someone else comes in, not having the courage or the willingness to say, yeah, the answer to is an alternative is I have to ask. I have to ask for help. You know, what do you think? Even those who we are resistant to getting instructions from someone else, you know, what do you think is important? No? Yeah.
I can imagine at the level of athlete and executive that you work with, that it's not uncommon to run into people who are resistant to outside ideas, even if they say they want it. You know, they are at the very top of their profession. And when you get to a certain level of expertise or experience or I don't know what the right word I'm looking for, accolades, it can be tougher to listen to other people. And I'm sure in many of those situations, looking from the outside in, you can see somebody who, if they just ask for a little bit of help, might be able to make an incremental improvement that would make a significant difference in the outcomes they're achieving. So in those situations, have you found any approaches that we can help people ask for help, if that makes sense? Make it easier for people to open their eyes to the possibility and lead them to ask for the help, as opposed to trying to impose it on them when they might not be open to receiving it?
Yes. And it's my preferred approach because they have a point, no? They have succeeded. They are succeeding. Something works. So don't change the winning game. Just like that, makes sense. At the same time, they might not have the full answer to how far can I go? Because they know that if they don't evolve, someone is going to catch up, something's going to happen. So I like stories. So listening is such an important tool and skill because I ask them about, tell me what's working. So define what's working. So then another opportunity is to go to the future, no? If you would be even more successful, let's assume you are right now, no? What happened? Talk to me from the future. Now I have an opportunity to identify certain gaps because they're going to tell me, or they might say, well, but to do that, I would need this and that. So that consideration is not high pressure, no? Is I always want to understand what they're experiencing, how they got there, how they envision their lifestyle, their next steps, because sometimes the road of success is just about achievement, but there is no fulfillment to the degree that they want it. And that's an important balance, no? For me, the best situation is, as I achieve, I'm fulfilled. Not I have to achieve to be happy, you know? And then, is it meaningful, no? Do people care? They tell you, or you're sacrificing so much for achievement that you have a bit of fulfillment, but you have all these critics saying you're never available, or that's not the person that I want to see. Win all you want, but you're not nice. You know, we don't care, no? Because it's important to socialize that success. Now, we do things that I think respond to that question. If you're getting everything you want, if you're succeeding, how is the world better for it, you know? Are you the best in the world, or are you the best for the world at the same time? It's not either or. And I think that I like consultative selling, as is known, because it's the co-creation of the solution with the client or the person that at least sat with you. Now, at least it's now for 5 minutes, he's listening. And I have the opportunity to say, okay, let's start with what works. What is great about you, especially for kids? That's my first question. Tell me what's great about Jenny, you know? They don't expect it. And it helps them unpack many things, you know? From there, I can go to, is there anything that could be better? Or tell me what's the maximum expression of this and what needs to happen? Because then there is the expression of something significant that could be a need is the hook to start asking more, no? In this breakthrough opportunities to be defined.
And you talked about the opportunity to ask. And I know that you are an extremely curious human being. And I know that you have a love of questions. I'd like to go back on the topic of questions to sort of how we started the conversation, because I do feel like all that we talk about communication, most of the conversation about communication is about interpersonal communication. How do we speak with other people? How do we interact with other people? Whereas, you know much better than me, our intrapersonal conversation might even be more important. How do we talk to ourselves? How do we see ourselves? How do we motivate ourselves? How do we set expectations? And then what are we looking for to either confirm or violate those expectations? Are there questions that you are fond? Let me rephrase that. Are you questions? Let me rephrase that again. Apparently, I can't speak at all.
We are all a question for some of us. How are you a question? I love that. You know.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with it? What are the questions that you believe we should be asking ourselves to lead to improve performance and better breakthroughs?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we need to check our satisfaction versus the goals that are posted, no? Because sometimes, like Seth Godin says, we look at the gap, no? Between the aspiration and the satisfaction of actually doing the work I am moving towards, you know? So how is this joyful right now? Because I'm doing it and it becomes part of the plan, no? It is valuable, it is useful, it's not a distraction per se. Is it joyful that I'm doing this work, no? In this way? Can it be better? Because we all know that we could eliminate distractions, we could be more focused, I could accelerate the result by trapping myself just for a couple of days and playing with the habits development, you know, I'm going to find my triggers, I'm going to have my flow and enjoy it, I'm going to enjoy also the craving of, I'm going to stop right on time, so when I restart, it's going to be pleasurable. I want to reward myself for the whole day achieved, no? Those things are important because we are really tracking the ideal performance stage factors, no? That is, how am I doing physically? Do I have the right level of stimulation? Am I fatigued? Do I need to recover? How long is the recovery that I need to tomorrow or when I restart be ready, no? Be eager. Desire is very powerful. And I think it comes from first checking with the physical base. No? Then is how do I embody the work? You know, I can check if I'm not being locked in and just doing something is such a routine that doesn't allow for creative alternatives. No? And is the ritual of doing this joyful? No, I need to measure on a scale also how does it feel to move from stepping stone to stepping stone? Do I need advice at some point or for refinement or tacking, no, like a boat, like a ship? Am I on course? Having external support is important, not to have someone available, best friend or, you know, spouse or specialist. So these are, I think, basic questions, no? That belong to the bigger question is that, for example, every athlete has, you know, how can I get better?
No? Sure.
But leaders have the same question, especially the leaders that see themselves as corporate athletes. Many of my clients have become that, no? Now they can read reality from one key concept. This is the most hard-hitting concept that when I mention it in a corporate setting, opens doors to breakthrough. So it's manage energy rather than time. So this self-talk and these questions belong to how do I manage the ideal performance state process because I'm seeking breakthrough. And if I do this in this way, breakthrough will be there, no? Yeah.
Manage energy, not time.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by that statement for several reasons. I believe initially I can see the power in that because if we have our energy focused in the right direction, then we should be probably more productive and more efficient and enjoy what we're doing more. And I do believe it's easy to get like bogged down in how do I manage time? I'm terrible. Time management is one of my worst things. So part of me loves that statement because I don't have to worry about managing time anymore because I'm so bad at it. I'll just manage my energy instead. So I know that's not where you're going, but for me, I can sarcastically enjoy it that way. See, I don't have to manage time anymore. I just need to manage my energy. But I do feel like in a lot of ways, especially with a lot of the business clients I work with, that people have this obsession with efficiency. And for a lot of reasons, they should. Like if you're in production and you can be 5% more efficient over the course of a year, how many millions of dollars does that save you? So I understand that. But especially when it comes to communication, well, I'm trying to be more efficient in my communication. Well, I'm not sure that's the best approach to take because now if I'm valuing time over empathy, empathy is going to suffer. Like, so congratulations on being more efficient in your communication while also harming all of your relationships and missing opportunities along the way. Yeah. So I know I kind of took us away from there a little bit, but I would love to circle back and ask you to please explain what you mean by manage energy, not time, because I feel like that is a fascinating thought. And I saw it in your book as well. I want to make sure I plug your book. I saw it in your book as well. Thank you. I'm so glad that you brought it up.
Yes, that's a central concept summarized by my associate, Dr. Jim Lehrer, sports psychologist, because it really brings into focus that what I'm managing is my physiology and the ideal performance state. So if I manage the physical factors and the emotional factors, I might find more time because I can also be more creative and I make better shifts in thinking, prioritizing, discerning, selecting, categorizing, that what it was a blur at the beginning of the hour, suddenly I gained 15 minutes because it's this, this, and this, and this is sufficient. I can move on or I can take a break. So suddenly I can make stress recovery waves through the hour, through the morning, afternoon, through the day, through the week. I discovered through this the seasonality of my life, you know. I know exactly when I can take a vacation, not feel guilty, enjoy it to the fullest, you know, because I'm training recovery to come back and manage even better my ideal performance state. That becomes a lifestyle that way, no? So being aware of my energy output for that hour, how much energy would this task require? How am I feeling about it? Can it be postponed? Can I chunk it? No? I might not be able to finish this in 1 hour. So where are in my calendar, my color-coded calendar, where are these energy spots that I need to find? Because let's say this topic is high energy. At the same time, this type of thinking allows me to find when can I think? When can I do things that are not at 100% output? You know, when can I meet and have an insightful conversation, not rushed, because there is gold in there. because of the person, the topic, the team. No? And finally, when can I unplug? You know, every day and weekend, you know, holidays. So this is how this becomes manage energy rather than time. It's not the rigor of the squares in the schedule that are going to determine my productivity. It's how I really identify my connection with the state that I need to perform the task and do it at the very high level of result, no? It will shine because when someone reads it or sees what's on the website or go through the logic of what I'm writing, no? They say, well, they obviously there is clarity. And I think people reward clarity today, no? I'm intrigued by what you would say from the listening side, no? Because that's what I found. There is so much clutter that I identified two things. Clarity in communication is rewarded and also wisdom.
Yes.
But the wisdom has to come through the clarity. A friend of mine, he's wealthy and he gets hit by all the banks in, you know, 300 miles. And they all come with this pitch and the brochure and basically pricing. And I said, I want wisdom. I want to see what the people like me are deciding on. You know, I know that we might not be able to be in one room, but this consultant, this person, this banker has to tell me with clarity, no jargon, you, because I identify you as unique, should consider this, you know? And it's important, you know, in that sense.
Yeah, it's very important. So to go back and then come forward again, from my perspective on clarity, I agree 1,000% that clarity is rewarded. Clarity solves problems. A funny example that I think I used in a previous conversation that we had on the podcast was I coach youth baseball. So 5 and 6 years old, 6 year olds at this point. And at one point during practice, I said to the team, bring it in. And they were all out in the field. And when I said, bring it in my mind, that meant come to me because I wanted them to all circle around the coaches. We're going to end practice. I stood there and watched 11, 5 and 6 year olds run right past me into the dugout. And I start laughing. And the coach next to me is, well, I guess they're done listening today. I'm like, no, that's on me. I'm the lowest common denominator. If 11 people do one thing and one person thought something different, like I wasn't clear enough in my expectations. Therefore, it's on me. So clarity leads to understanding. Clarity increases our ability to resonate with others. So 100%. And honestly, that's something that I struggle with sometimes, especially with what I do and what I teach, because, and I'm sure it's true for you, we spend so much time with what we do that it's very easy for us to get into the minutiae, the small detail, the weeds, if you will, but then trying to explain it to somebody else or to help them in their own situation in a way that it's short, it's succinct, it resonates, it's clear. Like sometimes that filter is difficult for me. To get back to, excuse me, just for one, I didn't want to cough in everybody's ear. I apologize. To get back to your friend in the bank example, that's a really good point. I am fully in the court of teaching is the most important part of selling. Like if I'm in an engagement with a prospective client and at some point they tell me, I feel like I should be paying you for this, then I'm doing the right thing because they're going to be better for this conversation. So to use that example, I was just working with the team this past weekend on a retreat. And one of the little things we worked on is instead of saying what I do is, switch that to our customers rely on us for.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same message. But now to your point, I want to see what people like me are doing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if I sit down and I say, well, Carlos, people like how I help people like you is.
Yeah.
Well, okay, great. Maybe you're telling me the truth, but you're never going to sit down in front of me and say, well, Mike, you know, I'm not really good at my job and I don't understand people like you that well, but how I think I can help you, it's never going to come out that way. Right. But instead, if I can sit down and say, Carlos, often clients who have a wealth between X and Y typically seek my organization out because they are looking to A, B, C, D. Now, as you listen to that, you're thinking, oh, wow, now I'm learning. I am in that bracket. And that is what other people are doing. Please tell me more. And now we're making the connection and the price, although is always a factor, isn't as significant in the end. So your points are spot on from my perspective.
Yeah. And it all comes to managing energy rather than time, because it leads to clarity about how I live and how I can deliver, no? Because if it's blurry, it might not have clarity, you know, as a result.
And I'm writing that down right now. Who's managing clarity and energy and how we deliver. I love that. There's an interesting part of your fascinating, integral part of your background that you and I have never talked about before. And I appreciate you giving me permission to ask you about it during this show. But I can imagine that being an immigrant and where you come from and all of those experiences that you have play a really big role in your perspective, in your ability to manage your energy, in your ability to redefine problems based on what you've seen, survived, experienced before. To the degree that you're comfortable, I would be grateful if you could help us understand how your, I'm not even sure the right way to ask the question to be as respectful as possible, but how your life history and the immigration process, where you come from versus where you are now. And I know you're a world traveler as well, but how that immigration history has really impacted your perspective and set you up to be so successful in this realm of mental toughness and peak performance.
Thank you. Yes, I'm from Buenos Aires, Argentina. I was born in 1968. Democracy stopped in 63, and then there was a long line of dictatorships, military dictatorships. So basically, I voted once in my life, and that was it, when democracy returned many years after. I was educated in a Catholic school for leaders, and my parents liked the approach. I went to a British club to play tennis, which became my international language, not only a skill, because when democracy returned, there was 300% inflation per month. And I was studying medicine, up to 6 years of medicine behind me. And I was running 5 tennis clubs with my brother and a team. I was on national TV with a TV program doing some commentating. Gabriela Sabatini, the biggest star in Latin America, was just coming up. But I could not pay the gasoline at the end of the month. And I was absurd what inflation was doing to us. So at some point I said, this is going nowhere compared to my aspirations. I was really educated to be a citizen of the world. And my family being Lebanese and French and intellectuals and very curious. We didn't have television until we were 14 with my brothers. So we read a lot. We listened to a lot of conversations of very interesting people. That shaped a worldview. And I wanted to belong to the world. I wanted to travel and explore and see this people that had different views, no? So tennis became the crutch. Tennis became the passport. And I was I'm always very grateful that Dennis Vandermeer, the best tennis teacher in the world, with whom I had worked a little bit in clinics in South America, he said, come on over, we'll figure it out. So I was in Hilton Head Island, basically learning the whole business, starting from scratch. Forget that I had all this medical background, doesn't matter. Tennis is the conduit. And that's where I met Dr. Jim Lill, a sports psychologist. And I very quickly figured out this is the future. Mental toughness is the future. He was formulating his program. And on a handshake, I said, I can make you world famous. And I'm going to go to Germany. And I think I can build an international speaking tour. And that's what I did. I went to Dusseldorf. I lived with a friend who very kindly hosted me. And together we work on this tour. I was very successful. So IMG, the largest sports agency in the world at the time, that was at the Nicola Tiri Tennis Academy with the best tennis generation ever in America, Sampras, Agassi, Courier, Selle, all these players. They said, well, who is this guy? you know, that did this, you know, what does he want? I said, well, I want to work with Jim. I want a green card. We can grow this, you know. So that's what we did. And, but it was when Gabriel Sabatini won the US Open in 1990 after working with us for 5 months, when she actually wanted to quit tennis, although she was number three in the world, that the world paid attention because someone in the New York Times wrote that we had been assisting her. And the next day, the phone was going off the hook with all types of calls, not only sports, you know, corporations, etc. So that was the beginning of a long journey of evolution for Jim and associates to build their own company, which was sold 30 years later to Johnson & Johnson, you know, in Lake Nona. I was invited to go to Europe first to build a very large tennis facility as an example of potential, now what can be done with this concept. But there were my Swiss banker friends who said, these topics, we want them for our teams. I think this is our breakthrough. And it was true. I mean, from one speech to working with teams to doing culture change over now 23 years, there were tremendous breakthroughs and transformations personally and for the teams, with revenue growth as well. And that validation helped me work with other industries, other sports. And one of the most rewarding is Formula One with Pietro Fittipaldi, with Enzo, his brother, Formula Two now, because it was unexpected, but it allowed me to say, okay, I know what works, which is what we've been sharing today. Teach me your sports. Teach me your industry. We're going to co-create the solution because we're going to find the links between what works, what doesn't work, what could be better, the behaviors. And then we can ritualize certain things, and then we have to monitor this over time. And when someone leads from the front, this is possible. You know, if someone expects that the content alone will excite people, is not that effective. You need to institute, you know, the change. You need to monitor and nurture the transformation. Anytime a leader said, this is the path because it's human and because we are designing it, Carlos just gave us the underpinnings, you know, it worked very well. So,
Well, yeah. I appreciate you sharing that story with us. And I know there's a lot more to it. And if we had more time, I know that you would go into it. But you know, where you came from at a time in Argentina was very difficult, to say the least. So for you to come from that background, from a very culturally diverse family that sounds like was teaching you how to think and be curious from a very young age, to then go create your own future. I mean, talk about breakthrough moments. You know, certainly what I get from that story is, oh, come on over, we'll figure it out. Okay, well, now I'm going to go to Germany and figure it out. I'm going to be in Switzerland and figure it out. Now, exactly. I'm going to be in Italy and figure it out. And we'll just continue to kind of create our own problems that need to be solved. But I love it. Your whole story is completely fascinating to me. And I've been taking notes throughout this entire conversation. And I'm so thankful to be geographically close to you so we can continue these conversations, hopefully over coffee or lunch or dinner moving forward. And I would love to potentially, if you're open to it, have you back on the show to continue going down this road, because I feel like it's not just one topic, but it's a series of topics. How do we see ourselves? How do we see the world? How do we see our challenges? What are we saying to ourselves? What are we saying to others? How do we position ourselves that makes such a difference? And I can imagine, just as a fan looking from the outside in, the work you do in the world of racing is so important because of the pressure that they're under. And when you're doing 200 miles an hour, 3 centimeters away from another vehicle doing 200 miles an hour with 2 feet of clearance between a metal fence on either side, you know, your focus has to be impeccable. There can't be a stray thought. So I can only imagine not only the importance of the work that you're doing, but what you're learning in that environment as well.
Yes, I think that other than military, astronaut, jet pilot, Formula One is the next level now. a tennis player reacts at 0.5 seconds. Pietro reacts at 0.2. No, wow. And all the others. So that's the world. That's really the requirement. Mm-hmm. What do we do with this skill to make decisions at that speed? No, but it's also in an existential way is a nice message to the rest of us. You know, if you're going to bet everything on yourself, you know, and go to the limit, what do you need? You know, because why suffer? How can this be joyful? Again, not that question. And that's how I approach it with Pietro and Enzo and younger talent who's now going up the ranks in other categories. No, is you need to be safe, and this has to be enjoyable, and this is what really clinches everything for all the others. I want you to be the best under pressure.
Yes.
That's your title, the best under pressure. And that really sinks in. That really makes sense to them, no? Yeah, therefore, I understand why I need to do this. No? It's not a nice to have. It's not an imposition. It's not because others have sports psychology with them, you know? Everybody could have the entire team of top 5 Formula One driver, you know, maybe 100 people behind them, but it's how you apply this so it works, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For all of us,
yeah.
When the moment occurs, we are the one at the controls.
Yeah.
If we're at the one at the controls of a race car doing 200 miles an hour, if we're the one with controls in our meeting, if we're at the one at the controls at our kitchen table with our family, if we're at the one in controls for, you know, whatever we do in our hobbies and our lives, then having people like yourself or others who can educate us and teach us how to think, see, act, feel better, perform better is important. But when the chips hit the table, we still have to perform.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
I can't thank you enough for this conversation. Like I said, I've been taking notes and I still have questions that I feel like I need to ask. So hopefully we can do this again sometime. Yeah. I have to imagine that there are people listening to this conversation right now who are thinking, I need to learn more. So for the people who are looking to find your book, The Glass is Full and a Half, for people who are looking to connect with you and find more ways to potentially learn from you and from your experience, where should they go? How can they find you and your work?
Yes, thank you. Well, my website has all the descriptions, www.salumminternational.com. And on the navigation menu at the top, you can see all the categories. Thank you.
And I will make sure to have links to all of your websites, your videos, your book, everything embedded with the show so people can have direct access to it in the show notes.
Great. Thank you.
Carlos, again, I cannot thank you enough for your time and sharing all of your wisdom and your insight with us today. Thank you so very much. It has been a pleasure. I'm excited to share this conversation with everybody, and I'm excited to keep our conversations going the next chance that we have. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Michael. And please continue your work because it's connected to the zeitgeist, you know, the speed of the times, and it's very much necessary, of course.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. And at this point, I'm too far to quit. So I've got to keep going. But I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you.
Carlos, thank you for what I knew was going to be an amazing conversation. Your perspective is infectious. You're right. You do sell optimism. You are an internal optimist, but really, I think you sell so much more than that. You sell the opportunity for people to see themselves in a way and believe themselves in a way and experience themselves in a way that they likely haven't before, or at least not in certain sets of circumstances. Thank you so much for sharing pieces of your life story with us, for your expertise, a little bit of what you teach and how you work with people, and giving us so many takeaways that we can work with. The world really is your theater of purpose. And thank you for sharing your art with us today. I truly do appreciate it. And thank you to everybody that took the time to listen to this conversation. I'm grateful that you continue to choose to share your time with us. Thank you so very much. Speaking of thanks, on the way out, let's thank the sponsors one more time. Humantel. head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class training on how to identify when emotions are shifting by accurately understanding how somebody's facial expressions and body language are betraying what they're feeling on the inside. I highly recommend their training. Please check it out. Go over to see the International Association of Interviewers at certifiedinterviewer.com. Check out all of their online content, all their in-person training, the membership benefits and resources, and of course, learn what it takes to qualify for and earn the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And lastly, Inquasive. Please head over to inquasive.com to explore the programs that we customize for our clients when they ask us to work with their leadership teams, their HR teams, and their sales teams again to teach them how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. And if you are enjoying these conversations on listening and communication and you'd love to learn more about the research and experience behind the discipline listening method and how to apply it across many different professional and personal contexts, you can pick up a copy of the book, The Discipline Listening Method, at both Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Thank you so much for being here. Please take an extra second, like the show, subscribe to the show, share the show, leave your thoughts and feedback, message us directly. We would love to know what you like about the show. What would you like to see different about the show? Who else would you like to see on the show? Please let us know. We would love to hear and integrate your feedback. Thank you all so very much for being here. Carlos, thank you again for joining us. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.